Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 9th of June with me, Ian Welsh. Last week I was in Minneapolis for Innovation Forum's Future of Food USA conference. While I was there, I was delighted to record some quick-fire reflections on the conference sessions with some of the panellists and participants. So a little later, there are some insights from Ted McKinney from the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, Regrow's Anastasia Volkova, and Talia Vunaki from the FAIR Initiative. That's all to come. First, though, it's time for a quick roundup of some sustainable business news. New research from the University of Leeds in the UK suggests some eye-wateringly large sums of reparation if developed economies are held liable for overshooting their carbon budgets. Collectively, there could be up to $170 trillion due from countries such as the US, the UK and the states of the EU. The US alone could be on the hook for $80 trillion. Wealthier countries have already been responsible for most of the current and past emissions, but also more likely to exceed future carbon budgets too. The Leeds researchers used estimates from the IPCC to measure total global carbon budget and individual country budgets. They then investigated the cuts that developing economies would have to make to compensate for the developed world and quantified a cash amount that would compensate them using the existing IPCC framework. The research's publishing coincides with the UN's annual climate change conference, this year held in Bonn in Germany, that sets up the conversations for the COP28 annual meetings coming up in December in the United Arab Emirates. Negotiations for progressing the framework for climate loss and damage and how the global north should compensate the south, outlined at COP27, will be a key talking point at COP28. Plastic recycling has long been pushed as a big part of the solution for the plastic pollution problem. However, new research published by Cambridge University suggests that recycled and reused plastics used for food contact can spread dangerous chemicals and substances, including benzene, formaldehyde and heavy metals. The new Cambridge study is a synthesis of hundreds of previously published papers on recycled plastics and concludes that hazardous chemicals can accumulate in recycled material and then migrate into foodstuffs and then for potential human exposure. The research identifies over 850 chemicals used in PET recycled plastic, including potential toxins. Some of the chemicals are added during the recycling process, either from the recycling itself or contamination in the recycling stream. Food from plastic's first use or cleaning products used in recycling can be absorbed. The problems can impact reusable plastic items for food contact, including cutlery and water bottles. Ultimately, the study concludes the only safe approach for consumers is to avoid plastic as much as possible, which is, of course, more easily said than done. While nature-based solutions are what everyone's talking about, pension fund investors are still not attracted to natural capital assets. That's the conclusion of a study by Pensions for Purpose, which finds that 62% of UK pension funds have failed to make such an investment. Lack of sufficient data to make an informed decision is cited as the main reason, with many investors struggling to de-link biodiversity issues from climate change. Over a third of the investors surveyed stated that they did not think that nature falls within their remit of responsibility. The deforestation impacts of agriculture is something that we've covered extensively, and a new report from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization demonstrates the challenges involved. The study compares the impacts of smallholder farmers and large-scale agriculture and found that in the period 2000 to 2018, most of the forest converted to cropland and grassland was down to small-scale farming, accounting for 68% of agricultural-driven deforestation, with 32% caused by large-scale farming. In total, agriculture accounted for almost 90% of deforestation, more than had previously thought to be the case. Small-scale cropland conversion accounted for 71%, and small-scale livestock grazing accounted for 64% of deforestation. There was also some significant regional variation, small-scale farming accounting for 97% of agricultural-driven deforestation in Africa, but only 52% in South America, for example. Small-scale farming was defined for the study as being activity applying non-industrial methods and low-technology production processes over limited areas and for which the labour force is the main production investment. Large-scale farming is defined as activity that does apply industrial and higher technology production processes extending over a large area and involving significant capital investment on machinery or infrastructure. The research was undertaken using a remote sensing and sampling approach, and the study offers some practical solutions including using earth observation technology that could help lessen deforestation impacts. At Innovation Forum's Future of Food event in Minneapolis last week, I was delighted to speak with Ted McKinney, CEO of NASDA, Anastasia Volkova, CEO of Regrow, and Talia Vunaki, Senior Manager for Research and Engagements at the FAIR Initiative. I'm with Ted McKinney, CEO of the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, NASDA. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what NASDA does?
Well, NASDA is the Association of State Departments of Ag. So 50 states or commonwealths and four territories would be our members. 107 years old, and we look after all things state agriculture, which means promotion of ag in those various states, which means some regulatory and many, many, many other things. So if it's ag in those states, it would be through our members.
We talked yesterday here at the Future Food Event in Minneapolis about some of the rules of regulatory bodies. How do you think we best find the balance between the environmental impacts of agriculture with the continued need for more productivity?
Well, I am a fan, and I think most of agriculture, farmers and the processing lines as well, would say that the whole attention to climate smart ag is just, it's appropriate, and we celebrate that. I think there's also a worry, though, that we're going to be so focused on doing anything and everything that we lose productivity. And the only thing more important than climate smart ag or climate change addressing is that we feed people by 2050. And I think sometimes that out of skew. So the beauty and the message that I try to promote is both are okay. You can do both. We can address climate smart issues, but also increase productivity. And our own farm in Indiana is a great example. So in its simplistic form, that's how I would describe it.
What are these productivity measures that are so important? What should the agriculture be focusing on in terms of productivity?
Well, historically, things like no-till farming and minimum-till farming and adoption of hybrid seed and adoption of crop protection chemistries and feed additives and nutrients, all of those things have been a big part of agriculture in the past. Looking forward, the whole climate smart ag is bringing all kinds of new opportunities. I think there's still a sorting out going on of which ones are the ones to bet on, which ones can provide a farmer or a rancher with an income, as well as the provider of that technology. But I think the future is so, so exciting. I'll give another example. There's a product called Bovaer that Elanco has licensed. And for it to be able to bring methane emissions down by 50% as a feed additive and not affect the performance of that animal is so exciting. Gene editing for the crop world is just so exciting. So I think the future is very bright on our technology. And I think a lot of that will address or can help address climate change, but also help on productivity.
Something that came up a lot in our session was the pros and cons of a regulatory versus a voluntary approach. Where do you stand on that?
I start with the fact, as a farmer, as I grew up on a farm, is that farmers want to do the right thing if provided the incentive. So I'm going to always start, and my second step, and my third step, and my fourth, fifth, and sixth step will be give voluntary a chance. Farmers are the original environmentalists. Trust me, they want to do the right thing. If given the incentive, they'll move in that direction. Now there's education, there's teaching, there's coaching, so there's that to be involved. Farmers just are repulsed at the immediacy of some people that want to go with regulations. And that's why I'm so complimentary of Team USDA and the government in the US now for introducing voluntary measures. And look at the response. I'll contrast that to my friends, and they are friends, in Brussels, who have taken a very regulatory approach, and it is not going well. So there's maybe a time for some regulations. We have to comply. There's got to be an assurance that an investment that a company or a government makes is getting a return. But let's start and hopefully finish with voluntary regulations or voluntary measures as much as possible.
It's very interesting, yes. We had a definite number of conversations around the different culture, how there just appears to be more of a regulatory approach in the EU, and that's one that perhaps is more accepted in the EU than it would perhaps be in the US.
Probably so, and that's just fine. I am not here to dictate to our friends in the EU how they should manage their farms. If they feel like a regulatory approach is fine, it's when they then say, oh, all of you that might be importing product to us, you also have to follow the same rules. Never mind that we may have already achieved. I'll take my farm. We ship corn occasionally to Europe. We're down 18% in our use of phosphorus. We're down entirely on the use of insecticides. And I'm expected to be penalized because of regulations there when they're needing our corn? Come on. we've got to work through this. So I do see the dichotomy, not trying to tell them what to do, but don't impose that on the rest of the world, because productivity will go down, starvation will go up. Not a good answer in terms of our ideas about productivity.
Okay, let's look to the future then. What are the reasons that you're hopeful that we're going to get a grip of all these issues, like environmental issues, the productivity issues that we're talking about?
Well, I'm so excited. Well, let's go back a few decades when Malthus declared that we were going to run out of food. Love Malthus, but he was proven wrong largely because innovation allowed agriculture, farming specifically, to keep up with the population increase. The same can be done now. There's nothing magic about that. We're going to add another couple billion people by 2050. The answer to that is innovation. And oh my, at this conference you've sponsored, we've heard so many fantastic ideas about innovation. Let's cultivate those. Let's bring those along. Let's let farmers try them. And I hope farmers find some benefit as they have hybrid seed corn and mechanization and genetics and all the other things. I am very bullish on the future, but we have to do it in the right way. A heavy-handed regulatory approach, this thing will explode right in somebody's face.
Innovation Forum, we always like being a forum for innovation. Ted, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks so much, Ian.
I'm with Anastasia Volkova, CEO and co-founder of Regrow. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
You said just now in a session that it's going to be hard under business as usual for us to continue to grow enough food. Why is that?
We cannot necessarily predict the climate change impacts on agriculture, given especially the last few years has become evident to everyone that the global warming effects, continuous droughts and floods are leading to catastrophic losses of productivity at a country scale. We've seen that in 2019 across the Midwest with massive floods. We've seen it in 2018 and before in Australia. We've seen it now in Europe. It's very challenging for us to see how, without adopting regenerative agriculture, we would get to a place where we can assure a supply chain.
Okay, I mean, I guess a great deal of this comes down to, if resilience is the what, then regenerative is the how.
Exactly. Resilience is the what we're moving towards. Regenerative is the practice. We can implement it. It's going to be varied depending on which farms and which locations and which areas we're going to implement it on. But resilience is the ultimate state that everyone is aligned to. The farmers, the processors, the food manufacturers, the consumers, because that is what will ultimately be able to sustain life on the planet if we have resilient production.
A lot of this is about data, isn't it? And we heard just now that two-thirds of farmers don't collect data. How can we change that?
It's a question whether we should change that. I believe on one hand, we will give them more incentives to actually monetize their data in a way. We often talk as Regrow about the opportunity that as a farmer, if you already have brilliant practices and you can demonstrate them, not only by us showing the data for your farm as third-party verification, but also for you to provide the first-party data, you will be able to be paid more for your commodities, be compensated for your practices based on the carbon intensity that is lower of the commodity that you're providing. So on one hand, that financial incentive is really what moves the entire value chain forward, not just farmers. But on the other hand, I believe through the application of technology, you would not have to ask absolutely every farmer to record every piece of information. We do have advanced satellite imagery and modeling to really help with filling in the gaps where we don't have the information. So it doesn't have to be so painful.
There are reasons for hope.
There's reasons why there's the holes that we need to fill, exactly. Yeah. It's like because that data collection is hard, there's not been a business case why that information would be needed. And I think now, in the world of expectation of more transparency, of Gen Z consumers that are ready to pay for sustainably marketed and sustainably grown food, I think the farmers will appreciate that incentive.
Well, let's hope that the right and the changing business models do evolve as we go forward. But for now, Anastasia, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ian.
I'm joined by Talia Thunaki from the FAIR Initiative. Welcome.
Thank you, Ian.
We had a very well-attended session yesterday, which really turned into a bit of a self-help session, looking at the challenges around setting science-based targets, and in particular, the FLAG guidance, which has come out recently. You were tasked with giving us the overview of the FLAG guidance, which you did brilliantly. So I wonder if perhaps we can have a bit of a discussion about that now. What are the key points that you think companies need to bear in mind when they're using the FLAG guidance to set realistic SBTs?
The first thing I want to bring out is that the FLAG targets encompass quite a few elements that companies are already likely doing, and that's what we see through the Coller FAIRR Protein Producer Index. it just brings them all together under one concise, effectively, framework, best way I would describe it. And in terms of prioritization of what companies should do and take into account, first of all is the requirement to set a zero deforestation commitment by 2025. That will require actually collaboration among companies that are sourcing from areas of high risk from deforestation. We have to meet those targets. We have to work towards a zero deforestation commitment because the emission reduction potential that is possible by managing those land use change emissions estimated at 38%. And from those land use change emissions, 80% of those emissions are from deforestation. So that'll be the first thing. The second thing is engaging with their suppliers. Part of the FLAG guidance is very much asking for quality of data. And to do that, companies will need to really talk to their supply chain to get the right information, the right data, because they need to be able to calculate those emissions. So there are three categories. It's the land use change emissions. So that is from deforestation and land conversion. The second category are land-related emissions other than land use change. So now we're talking about emissions related to animal farming from manure management and also emissions from fertilizers, for example. Then the third category of emissions as part of creating that baseline are the carbon sinks, so carbon removals that need to be also calculated. There's going to be a lot of work that needs to happen from companies, but it is possible.
And also, you're also involved with the Protein Producer Index. What are the specific challenges for the protein sector that you've seen?
Going back to deforestation being one, understanding, having a clarity of the supply chain. What we see is that the largest meat producers have set commitments for their own operations and their direct suppliers, but now they need to look into their indirect suppliers. That would be one of the key challenges.
Moving forward, how do you expect progress? What do you expect progress to look like?
Other than tackling deforestation, that's one. The other areas is really scaling up all those projects that companies are doing on regenerative agriculture. A study conducted by my colleagues at FAIR, analyzing 75 of the largest food and ag companies in the world, showcased that more than 60% of them are discussing regenerative practices as part of their sustainability journey. But only a third of them track the action. They've got targets. They've got targets on how much of the products will come from a land that's managed in a regenerative way. So I think now what we want to see is scaling that up, because there's a very significant opportunity there to meet the FLAG targets.
I think the thing that came out from a session, and in fact other discussions we've had around these guidelines, is that there was a sense of goalposts being moved. How much do you associate with that?
Yeah, okay, so that's a difficult one, but there's a reason those FLAG targets were set, and that is to acknowledge that the land sector is responsible for a huge amount of emissions, and under the science-based target, land-related emissions are not taken into account. So they account for more than 20% of all emissions globally. So this is why they've been added, is because we not only understand their role they've got to play, but also the mitigation potential, again, going through back through regenerative agriculture, but also agroforestry, for example, enhancing soil carbon, which is under not removals, and enhancing soil carbon is, I believe, under emission reduction. There's a real potential. So that's why they've added those FLAG targets. It's not to necessarily penalize the sector. It's actually to recognize the potential to address global warming.
I mean, I think somebody said yesterday that, in fact, we got what we asked for. It is indeed. It's very challenging and very complicated. And these guidelines do go some way towards addressing the significant challenges. It's going to be interesting to see how companies do address them.
What's nice from the conversation yesterday is to see how many hands were raised when we asked, how many of you are in the process of working towards setting FLAG targets? And that was really encouraging.
It certainly was. Talia Vunaki from the FAIR Initiative, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
The Innovation Forum website is, as ever, the place to go for all the usual analysis and interviews. As our spring event series has unfolded, my colleague Diana Kim has been compiling some website posts with links to relevant content related to each event. Do check them out if you're coming to the Future of Climate Action event online next week, or the Sustainable Apparel and Textiles event in New York towards the end of the month. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh. Until next time, goodbye.